Welcome back. Another episode. I think we're at 335. Joe, you survived the Pineapple Express?
I did. Still standing. It hit further south with the most ferocity and wiped out LA. We were ordered to evacuate and suggested that we go to Los Angeles, but we tend not to pay any attention to what the state suggests for us. So we found a way to stay put. We actually didn't leave. We were prepared to leave. We had, in case the mudslide was heading right at us, we would have gotten out with the pets and the valuables and whatnot. But we actually stayed put. We just didn't have any utilities. However, we're used to that. So it was actually quite nice. I like those evacuation moments because it cuts us off from the rest of the world for a while, and I feel that there's just more sanity in such a condition.
Time to reflect.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah.
a moment of a solitary thought and reflection. They don't want that.
No.
Number of events. I know we agreed to talk about Saul Alinsky this week. Let's talk about a couple of issues that came up this week first. One was this Tucker Carlson interview with Vladimir Putin, of course, the Russian head of state. This was interesting because Tucker released a video announcing it, kind of explaining why he was doing it, which was interesting. As far as it goes, it was a pretty good summation of why it was important to interview the Russian head of state, get his side of the story or Russia's side of the story, so to speak. But apparently, this is not considered acceptable in the West anymore. There was a time, I mean, I remember like during the Cold War when arguably Russia was considered a more dangerous adversary than the current Russian Soviet Union was considered more dangerous adversary than the current Russian state, which is more traditional. It was very common to have Russian officials interviewed in their side of the story, so to speak. Even interviewed Castro. Castro would be interviewed by Barbara Walters, in many respects, even celebrated and justified in the press, sort of the other side. The idea that Russians are people too, therefore we have to talk to them, the era of detente and these things. And so it wasn't considered an act of treason to simply ask the Soviet premier's opinion on something, or whatever value you want to place on that, or take it at face value. But now it's been warped into a situation where even if you try to get the Russian opinion on something, or the Russian president's opinion on a current crisis like Ukraine or Syria or whatever, wherever, you're committing treason. And it's the job of the U.S. government, or U.S. government farms it out rather to the networks, cable television. Although Russian TV RT was actually banned in the West, which was again disacceptable, and I was canceled, so to speak. So you couldn't get the Russian perspective on these issues. It was supposedly live in a free society where there's the free exchange of ideas will determine what policy is, because the best idea always wins, right? But that's unfortunately, or at least apparently, that's no longer the case, because we have to be protected from from Russian propaganda. Meaning, we can't be the American public can't be left to decide these things for themselves based on the information they're given. They have to be shielded from other views, and we're given this cartoonish view of Putin as an aggressor, bloodthirsty tyrant who wants to take over Europe, unless if we stop supporting Ukraine. And of course, this what the what Tucker Carlson did do is give Putin. I haven't seen the interview. I've heard reports. I haven't had 2.5 hours between then and now to watch, sit back and watch it. But what I understand is he has laid out a broad historical case for the Russian civilization and its relationship vis-a-vis the West, and said that Russia was seeking peace with the West, and the West rejected his olive branch, and that's where we are today. And he made the case for that. But what I thought was more telling was the response. Apparently, the European Union is considering declaring the interview illegal and penalizing Twitter X and other platforms for broadcasting it, because the people in the West, particularly the United States, need to be protected from Russian propaganda, lest we become Russian bots.
Right. And this is a completely incoherent position, because there's almost nothing in the interview which could, be effective propaganda for people in the West. The only sort of important information that came out that might be novel to a lot of Western listeners was Putin's revelation that at the beginning of the war, Russia drove with a relatively small force, but they easily swept aside the Ukrainian army and came all the way to Kiev. Mm-hmm. Forget this. And then you have the mythology that it was the heroic Ukrainian army that drove the Russian back, and that the territory that they were driven back from is now the, you know, the percentage of victory that the Ukrainian army can maintain for territory recovered from the Russian. Well, all that is nonsense. Putin pointed out that they were in negotiations with Ukraine to end the conflict. It was basically terms had been agreed to before Boris Johnson came and scuttled all of this. But in the negotiations, they told Putin that, well, this agreement can't be particularly legitimate when you have a gun at our head. And Putin agreed with this and voluntarily removed his army. So that was information that, you know, is very useful, I think, for the West to have, because it sort of underscores how impotent the Ukrainian army is against Russia. And it, you know, negates the idea that Ukraine has any real chance against the Russian
army. Wasn't it reported as it was a forced retreat because of an offensive by the Ukrainians?
That's how it's actually been reported. And yeah. Putin, just, you know, with a bold face, he just pointed out the truth. He goes, no, look at the documents. You'll see that the timing of our, you know, withdrawal was completely related to what we thought was going to be, you know, an agreement that we would accept. So the whole idea that the Ukrainian army, you know, pushed back on the Russians and were successful is ludicrous, and it's just a propaganda point. And that was in the interview. But it was, other than that, I didn't really see much that would be very meaningful to the West in terms of propaganda. And I would just say that I'm not seeing anyone in Western media give an explanation of what the interview was. I mean, Tucker Carlson seemed to be befuddled by Putin's response, you know, when asked about the causes of the war. Putin went into a half-hour description of Russian.
starting in the 9th century.
And Carlson occasionally said, well, how is this relevant? But,
well, history is always relevant, isn't it? I mean, that's
Of course. Yeah. But you see, what was being missed is that Putin wasn't addressing the West. He could care less about the West. He wasn't. His answers were all carefully crafted propaganda for his people, because his role there was to create propaganda that would, you know, continue the populist befuddlement as to why this war is continuing to go on. What is the actual purpose, you know, here of the Russians? And so, and I think the best sort of way, incredibly, to understand the interview would be Clancy's book, Red Storm Rising, which is, you know, about a conventional war between Europe, between NATO and Russia. So it's applicable to the current thing in the Ukraine. And there he talks about the propaganda that was used against the Russian people before it began. And literally what Putin's, his long-winded historical explanation of all of this could have been right out of the book. It was that parallel to what Clancy was saying, that the kind of appeal to this, you know, sense of a people, of a history, and that is what creates the pretext, because this is what it's all about, for war. And then one thing that hasn't been brought out by the Western press or analyzed is Putin's, you know, we talked about, well, yeah, we want to have a treaty, but one of our conditions is the denazification. Now, yes. this is critical, because this is the Russians' side of the perpetual conflict. Because let's face it, Tim, Nazism is not a real thing. I mean, yes, it's a category of reality, but it's a philosophy which can emerge anywhere under any condition. And it is sort of in the eye of the beholder to some extent. And so there is never going to be an end to the Nazism that Russia can perceive inside of Ukraine until there are no Ukrainians left. Now, moreover, there is a contradiction that's very easy to see inside of Putin's response, in that he talks about how the Ukrainian and Russian people are really just one people, and that there is, no real difference between us, and so that there should be this unification of the land. And he appealed into the 8th century, all of these ideas. But he then said, well, we're not going to really stop until there's been this denazification. However, the fact is, the hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians who are being slaughtered on the front lines have nothing to do with Nazism. None of them, these are not the battalions, which are very rare actually inside of Ukraine, which have the Nazi symbols, the Azov. These guys aren't on the front lines. The people who are dying, the people who the Russians are slaughtering, are the Ukrainian populations who you have to press gang into service. They don't want to be there. None of these people have any interest in fighting against the Russian army. So the rationale that Putin is giving is false. It's just propaganda. The idea that we're there to denazify, what they're really there to do is to depopulate. That's and but they can't they in order to keep the Russian population bamboozled, they have to give them the idea that, well, actually we're unifying the race. Well, this is preposterous. You are exterminating the race. And the idea that we're not really going to negotiate until there's been denazification, this is a kind of attrition concept, very parallel to what NATO is saying, is that, well, we're not really going to negotiate until we regain the Crimea. So both sides can basically sit there as, halves of this pressure press, which is exterminating the Ukrainian population. And the own and the American people and press are just, in a state of dream world where they can't see this. They can't see that this is just obvious pretext on both sides. Putin, when he talks about like the reasons that Poland and Hitler, had this conflict, and he basically said it was a kind of an internal situation between the two of them, and Poland was misbehaving to some extent. Wait a second, Putin. I mean, why don't you mention the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, where you decided that you could work with Hitler to divide Poland? You see, he doesn't bring up any of the Bolshevik malevolence. He just tries to, because that would require, you'd start to get into the Holodomor and all of these other things, which would break apart the propaganda force that he's trying to levy against, the Russians. And so I thought it was a very disappointing interview. I thought Carlson was pathetic, and I thought that it was actually kind of scripted. And what this does is, it doesn't it, it gives the idea that, well, at least Carlson is supposedly independent media is providing information. None of the things that came out will have any impact on mainstream media's position, vis-a-vis the war. And for Putin, it gave him a chance to outsmart or to show himself as kind of morally and intellectually superior to the West. He was correcting Carlson and giving him, you don't understand the historical context. But all he was doing is engaging in propaganda. And so the war is just going to continue, and the Ukrainian, population will continue to be genocided.
Well, it's interesting that he claims he's denazifying Ukraine, and then at the same time, the West, NATO, Victoria Nuland Crowder is claiming that Putin is Hitler.
Yeah, they have the perfect pretext. I mean, again, this is just ludicrous. The parallel here is Gaza. I mean, they're the pretext that what was given to the population is just ludicrous, right? You have the bikini girls on LSD and the rave dance, and here come the evil Hamas, and they start shooting them. This is stupid. Israel's all set to go. and they start genociding the Palestinians. Well, all they've done is create a pretext. They just are able to create a pretext that is sufficient. It's designed in a certain way to keep people in check so they don't recognize that the government is a secret society that's simply engaged in genocide. I mean, Putin was just playing his role.
Well, one thing again, I point out is the what's telling about the Western response is that Tucker Carlson, whatever his motivations and his function with the interview is, that he should have to explain himself. All of a sudden, we have a situation where the U.S. provokes a war with Russia, and then everyone is supposed to agree that no one should be allowed to even hear the Russia's side of the story, which is intellectually,
It's ridiculous.
indefensible, because most of the people in the West, because they just follow the press, the Western press media, which is just a propaganda organ, think that Russia started the war when actually the U.S. did it when they staged a coup in 2014. This color revolution, then spent 8 years militarizing the country, effectively bringing it into NATO, and talk about NATO expansion to Russia's borders. And we do know that Putin did try to negotiate and come to some sort of agreement with the West. The West approved agreement, not agreement capable. And and when it did make agreements, it broke those agreements. And the killing never stopped in the Donbass. You had 15,000 people, I think, die between 2014, 2022, with the Kiev regime bombing the Donbass. And so basically, this was just a Russia didn't start the war, it intervened in a war that the US had started. And there's all types of dirty things the US, the Western intelligence agencies have been doing in the region, in the Caucasus, in the Balkans. We don't hear about this, the little dirty tricks, the supporting terrorist organizations, Islamic fundamentalists in the Caucasus, and like in Chechnya and in Yugoslavia, these things. All this, this goes back to the 90s. It's just constant meddling. The rape of Russia that occurred in the 90s and the aughts that Putin stopped. So this is why he's caught the ire of Victoria Nuland and the Jews that control the U.S. State Department. But it is funny that the EU issued a statement that they're gonna, the EU has a thing about false and dangerous information and banning it. Now they're trying to say this interview concert. This is just two guys sitting on talking, and as if the idea is you have to protect the public from countervailing or alternative views is absolutely is absurd on its face, and it just shows the utter corruption of the West at this point. Whatever Russia's regime is, the West is hardly a counterpoint to it at this point.
Yeah, and the errors that are being cited by Putin are these historical errors, which have nothing to do with the present conflict. I mean, I haven't heard anyone, even in the West, that has basically contradicted Putin's description of how this conflict came about, which, he talked about the Maidan being basically a coup. He talked about the Russian people being slaughtered in the Donbass, and that he really characterized the Russian special military operation as an intervention, not really an invasion. And of course, he pointed out that it was there to create a negotiated peace, and that they withdrew as soon as they thought they had the deal. So NATO, which at this point, I mean, how could anyone contest the fact that NATO deliberately provoked Russia? They've been trying to create this conflict for 30 years, and they finally have it. And the purpose of the conflict is, I think, now clear. They're just trying to depopulate Europe of Europeans.
Well, it's why
And
you unrest in France and Denmark and in Germany,
yeah.
largely in response to high energy prices brought about by the war. Who blew up the pipeline? And then I think there's in the interview there's a joke where I think Vladimir Putin accused Tucker Carlson of blowing up the pipeline, and he said, "No, the CIA did it." And Tucker Carlson asked him, "Well, why didn't you, if you have that information, why don't you manifest it and win the PR coup that would ensue?" And he says, "Well, because the Western media, the global media, is controlled by the United States, i.e., the forces behind the United States, and that's the forces." He says you can't win a propaganda war when the propaganda organs are controlled by one side. He's right about that.
No, Putin had some. I mean, I'm characterizing it as a negative in a negative way, but Putin had some really, clear-minded and good points. He pointed out that the West media is a controlled device, it's propaganda, and he gave a pretty good description of the beginning of the war about how Russia was, provoked, and it was the Russian-speaking populations in the Donbass that
Well,
really.
Russia's not a globalist expansionist power. It seeks dominance within its sphere of influence. Broadly speaking, if you subtract, the Bolshevik period, even then it kind of conformed to its traditional claims, just by geopolitical realities, is that it's always sought power within its sphere, and it can be brutal within that sphere, but from a sort of a Bismarckian, balance of power perspective, which what you really should have dealing with the real world, as opposed to this crazy Jewish neocon plan to control the world. You grant these countries this influence, and you deal with them on a on a on a on a on a even on a fair basis. Then you can maintain a peace, which Europe broadly did do for almost a century. You avoided a major conflict for a century,
I mean,
following that line. And it
and
wasn't
North.
until you had wars for democracy and sort of this Jewish influence on U.S. foreign policy that you had these crazy wars for global dominance, and we call it freedom,
I mean, the Russian people are looking at themselves as once again having to save the world. I mean, they defeated Napoleon, they defeated Hitler, and now they have to defeat
But that's that
NATO.
myth. That's that great the great patriotic war myth. That's another problem is dealing with sort of the contradictions of recent Russian history, which is particularly the Soviet period and the atrocities committed on the Bolsheviks. Of course, broadly speaking, there's sort of a mixed identity there because in one sense they want to appeal to the great patriotic war and the victory over Germany, which is forms the identity of the modern Russian state, the same way that World War II now and the New Deal form the identity of the modern American state. But
Well,
within that, there's a lot of myths and lies and propaganda,
people, I think in the West don't understand the degree that the Russian propaganda mythology is also based on the evil of Nazism. I mean,
Yes.
just as Hitler is, he's in everyone's refrigerator in the United States because, the propaganda device just they're always using him and the Holocaust supposedly. And there, Russia has exactly the same kind of mechanical propaganda. They have a church. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's their most recent and the most politically active cathedral. And it is literally dedicated to Nazism. They actually have Hitler's hat in like an altar there. Have you ever seen this? They have the evil of Nazism and their conquering of it is the strongest propaganda element in why the Russian state is great and why the people should adhere to its political class. And basically it's kind of used sadly in the same way with the Russian people as it is in the East. Hitler is this Swiss Army knife who can be used in all cases to justify government kind of increase of social control. So it's it would be nice to see the independent media push back on Carlson and Putin and the Nazism claim as a rationale or reason for Russia's continued genocide of the Ukrainian population, of whom none of which are being slaughtered or actually part of this Nazi class, which of course can never be completely exterminated under any condition because it's a philosophy, not a castle. So they will always be able to say, well, we have to kill more, even though we love them and there are people, we just got to keep going because there's a few left. And of course, it is that's just their half of the never-ending conflict. You recall, Tim, at the very beginning of this, we had discussions about this and we talked about the war is never going to end. The purpose of the war is to depopulate. And as long as what is really,
Well, if you make it ideological, it will never end.
right, the cause of the war is the fact that there are Europeans. This is really what the war is being fought. If they have to get, this is the central problem in Europe to the Judeo-Masonic controllers, is the fact they're Europeans. This is why the war is being waged. That's what, Tucker Carlson should be trying to move Putin to admit.
Now we had this did you see that the special counsel investigating Biden's mishandling of classified files has chosen not to prosecute? Special counsel Robert Harris said he will not recommend charges against President Joe Biden for his mishandling of classified documents while out of office, despite finding evidence that Biden willfully retained materials. This capped a year-long investigation that loomed over the his in Biden's 2024 re-election efforts. But and he drew, he tried he drew, he distinguished the Biden case from Donald Trump's case, who also faces criminal indictment for mishandling classified documents after he left office. Of course, Donald Trump is president, and so he has he's sort of plenary authority to declassify documents, whereas as vice president and as a senator, Biden didn't. Nevertheless, in the 300-page report, her painted a dim picture of the president, one that his political opponents immediately seized on. He described the president as an elderly man with memory issues who could not remember when he finished his term as vice president, when his son Beau died. So basically, what he's saying is the president of the United States, the current president of the United States, is senile. He's
Yeah, I
suffering
mean,
from dementia.
you
So he
can't
can't be
remember.
held responsible for his actions because he's not culpable, because he's not mentally capable of being held responsible for his actions. So why is he in the Oval Office?
It was just incredible. You brought this out to me. I had no idea was that this that the report was this revealing. I
Can
mean,
we
it
say
was
25th Amendment? Can we say 25th Amendment here?
right. The logic was, well, he's senile, so we can't really prosecute him. Well, but in that case, don't we want to remove him from office immediately? If you cannot remember when your son died, are you really capable? So the fact is, and I think everyone can recognize this, that Biden is not the president. He is just the body that occupies the desk, and there is Molly Ball and the tribe that she
But what is
runs.
would it be like Susan Rice as chief of
Yeah, I mean,
staff, these people who are managing him?
he's an ideal president because he cannot possibly complain about what he's told to say.
Who's the chief of staff now? I know he's Jewish. Is it Zients? The chief of staff now? Let me see. I'm gonna look that up here. I know, because the chief of, I think, isn't in the Constitution that the White House chief of staff has to be Jewish now. Wasn't there an amendment to the Constitution that said the White, whoever serves as White House chief of staff has to be Jewish? I mean, just
I think anyone who's in the White House at all who has any kind of position to power is either
yeah,
Jewish.
Jeff Zients. And he succeeded another Jew, by the way, Ron Klain. So
Amazing, but he doesn't complain about that.
Rahm
And
Emanuel, Jack Lew,
right, if you complain about, well, this is undemocratic, and these people are very
Yeah.
often in possession of kind of a self-interest, which is not a democratic interest. If you make these claims, which are just asserting facts, which are obvious, well, you're anti-Semitic. And maybe actually you are, in a certain way. It's like not necessarily in an evil way, but
Oh,
just
based on
it's,
what their definition, which is just your
yeah,
skeptical, critical Jewish power.
if they get to use the term their way, perhaps we can use it our way. So anyway, so it's a there is an undemocratic, a percentage of Jewish influence inside the White House, the State Department, the intelligence agencies.
Well, I think what was funny though was that he was
Sure.
berated at a White House press conference by various members of the press, and these people follow orders. They're not independent. So someone within the power structure is ordering that Biden, that his incapacity, lack of capacity to remember things, might affect how he discharges his office. That's being discussed now openly. Remember, this guy's seeking re-election, supposedly.
It's just incredible, and I really think he will run. I at one point I thought, like a year ago, I thought, no, there's no chance. I think the fact that he is becoming more senile
It's great.
is actually a kind of a positive attribute
Well,
as
for the
far as,
oligarchy, it's perfect, right?
yeah, I mean, he's literally a puppet, and so you don't have to worry about anything other than just. I think if he is actually elected to a second term. You'll have a situation where he won't even be reading from a prompt. There will just be, pre-packaged statements to questions that have been submitted, so he'll be like literally an invisible president that you'll never ever see him,
Yes.
or he'll just be there as, in fact, kind of like as a spiritual guide, and the statements will be kind of brought to us vis-a-vis the staff, and that's how we'll learn about what the president is up to these days.
Yeah, between AI and deep fakes and just shooting him up with drugs, making him wear sunglasses, you don't see his dilated, pupils. They can keep it's a weekend at Bernie's presidency at this point.
Sure.
But really, since when was the last president who really, asserted himself? Arguably, maybe Kennedy, and he paid for it with a bullet in the head. So, I mean, maybe arguably Nixon, and he was impeached. And again, this isn't necessarily advocating for either of these men's presidencies. You can do that in another time, but I'm saying just these are examples of men sort of being somewhat independent. So, I mean, that's so at this point, I mean, it's obviously, the presidency is managed by a cabal of managers, the as I mentioned, the chief of staff advisors, and they answer to the oligarchs. And there are about 400 or so Jews that populate the key offices in the White House, and they're the one determining policy, which explains so much the current state of the world. So that's that. That was funny. He's got again. He's like that mobster. I always wonder if he's like that. Remember that mobster who faked being senile to avoid prosecution? Maybe
Right,
Joe's do.
right.
Maybe Joe's doing it. So.
I don't think it's fake. I think
No,
that
he's yeah.
he would have to be an absolute genius to be able to pull off senility, in this way. No, he's gone. His mind is shot.
Well, yeah, I mean, he had a stroke when he was a relatively young man.
Yeah.
So, an aneurysm, rather. So it's and not, this was all known back in 2020. It was coming out. People were talking about his, his developing dementia that was clear, and now he can't even so much as he can't even suffer an interview anymore. So, again, that's the American state now. But.
I wonder if he's just the beginning of a perpetual stream of senile presidents. I mean, I wonder if this is actually going to be an established genre
Well,
that's a
it might be the reason why they're flooding the country with, with third worlders who simply won't care, have the agency to do anything about it. They want a tin pot dictatorship in the United States, and effectively, that's what kind of what you have in California now. An oligarchy doesn't have to worry about the will of the people because the will of the people is it's a babble. Last week, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer introduced a national security bill. He intertwined it with a foreign aid and a deal to maintain a 35-year national ban on plastic ghost guns, which I don't, it's like you can never just write a bill. This was supposed to be a bill to respond to the crisis at the border. They call it a crisis at the border. It's a crisis at the border because the federal government is simply not enforcing the laws that it's supposed to enforce. There is a 1952 law that allows the president to seal the border and shut off immigration if he seems it's necessary for the national security. And he can order the expulsion of all illegals. So there's no law that has to be passed to deal with it. There's no new bill that has to be passed. So nevertheless, they have had this bill in the Senate, which I think in like $12 billion for border security, whatever they consider that to be, which actually is more insecurity, but like $60 billion for aid to Ukraine and Israel.
Right, of course. Yeah.
So very little to do with the actual border, securing the border. Of course, Chuckie Schumer himself has declared himself to be a protector of Israel. That's his primary responsibility, out of his own mouth, by the way, U.S. Senate. So why would you let this guy sponsor a bill for the border for U.S. national security when his primary concern is Israel's national security, not the United States? But that's the problem we have in this country.
It just it's Tim, the condition of our nation is perfectly illustrated by what you just said. This is the problem, is that you have to first promote the neocon, world domination agenda and the support of Israel, or you can't do anything. You can't even have money for the border or I mean, it all has to come through the two great principles, that rule the nation. Otherwise, forget about it. It's not democracy.
Well, right now we have estimated 300,000 illegals pouring into the country every month, and this isn't just happening. They are recruited by various NGOs, and they're not refugees or they're not suffering from political persecution. They're simply seeking a better way of life, meaning they're seeking welfare and bennies to come to the United States. Of course, these NGOs are underwriting the invasion. They provide maps, transportation, reports, and actually even building bridges and roads to facilitate. And this is the efforts of the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, which apparently has an operation down in Panama doing this. Of course, our current head of U.S. Our current head of the Department of Homeland Security, who's in charge of the border, is Alejandro Mayorkas, who is himself a Jew and also an immigrant. And he was a former, I think, a board director, a member of the board of that organization. He's overseeing this, so he's guilty of treason. There was a I think an effort to impeach him last week that failed, but nevertheless, that's what's happening. And this is the problem we're facing again. Why would we have an immigrant, a Jew, trying to in charge of protecting U.S. borders when Jewish organizations are actively involved in undermining the U.S. border, you know,
Yeah, I mean,
that he was one time a board member of. It's,
right.
I
I mean,
mean, it's.
it's obvious, right? I mean, this is just ballot stuffing, and a diminution, dilution of like any kind of European political power,
You can't
you
have
know?
a
So,
functioning government in a Tower of Babel, which is what they want.
right. And so it's a, if you look at the NGOs, they're all Soros or Judeo-Masonic background. They organize these people, they send them up here, they have sanctuary cities set up so they immediately can go on welfare, so their lives have improved to some extent. And Molly Ball is there to organize their electronic ballots as soon as, you know, they've been here the required, like, what is it, 6 hours or something before they become citizens. So it's just ballot stuffing. And the Republicans are also guilty of treason. I mean, this should just be, you know, they should be defending against this with their lives, right? This is an absolute invasion of the country. There's no other way you can put it. It is done to basically overthrow. You talk about insurrection, right? This is truly an insurrection. They're going to use these people to create chaos, which will require more government, and then they're going to use them to stuff the ballot boxes, right? So that's, I don't really, I mean, obviously, there's no economic reason for their being up here. There was some report that that came out a couple of days ago saying that the illegal immigrants will add $7 trillion to our economy, GDP, over like the next, you know, like 20 years or something. I mean, it was just literally roll on the ground laughable, in which, you know, everything was exaggerated that could be positive, and none of the negative things could were being, you know, assessed. I mean, all you have to do to see the effects of these people and the other political, you know, kind of conditions that they're interacting with and part of, is just go to any inner city, you know, that has a whole bunch of these people in their
Well,
populations, and you
I'm
can see
sorry. Did these illegals enrich New York City? Have they enriched New York City? Have they
that. Right.
increased New York City's gross demand?
How's San Francisco doing, or any of the other cities?
How about
Minneapolis?
Martha's Vineyard didn't relish this increase in GDP.
So this is just really crude sophistry, you know, the idea that, well, that's actually something good that can
Have
come
they
out of this.
enriched California? That's California.
Yeah, nothing. You know, California, it's hard for them to stuff them in here because we have already so many basically migrant populations. They occupy all of the housing, and they have already established a kind of territorialism, and they don't like the immigrants, so they're pretty ferocious. So this isn't really where a lot of them are heading. I think maybe in maybe the sanctuary city of San Francisco will pick up some, maybe Los Angeles, but other areas, no, you don't see them because the Latinos are already here. They have the service jobs, they have a lot of the political power, so they're not interested in. And of course, you can't hit these people with racism because, frankly, they're related to a lot of the people that are being, you know, brought up here. You know, they're I think actually what someone should do is an analysis of a movement of these people to demonstrate that really what they're doing is they're bringing them into the swing states, the
Yes.
five states that, you know, can actually change the presidential election. And this is where they're going to stuff the ballot box. If they bring in like 10 or 20 million of them, which they are, I mean, and stuff them in there and then get Molly Ball to, you know,
Well, Chuck
gin up
Schumer,
the
when he
election.
talks about opening, securing the board, he's openly said that we need more illegals coming in.
Sure, of
So,
course.
I mean, of course, he doesn't think the same for Israel, you know.
No, well, that's of course not. I mean, that the goal is to create kind of a world domination, and to do that, you need to make sure the Europeans, among others, you know, cast absolutely no political power, and so that's the
But in
process
no
that's
country
going.
in the West has this ever been popular. Meaning, if you look at how people vote, the electorate always rejects illegal or mass immigration, yet the elites impose it on them. Whether the United States or Western Europe, England, these things, they all work for the oligarchs. And so it's because it's they're responding to basically Jewish money, moneyed interest. And that's what's happening. This is why it's happening. And the idea is just to ground the noses of the working class in diversity. That's what the guy in Britain said. You know,
but I would also point out that it isn't just money. It's the fact that they're conversos. A lot of these people are just lifetime actors. I mean, you know, Biden claims to be a Catholic, and he has, you know, Ash Wednesday, puts ash on his forehead, at least when he could remember to go to church. But I just disagree that with this being his reality. I think if we did DNA tests, people are conversos.
If you wonder why the Biden administration is not protecting the nation's borders, that indeed not administering laws that it's sworn to uphold, and immigration laws are those laws, it's simply ignoring them. You don't have to pass any more laws, enforce the laws that are currently on the book. And he does have the executive authority, he can sign an executive order to deal with the problem right now. He can order an Operation Wetback 2.0 and kick them all out if he wanted to. But he doesn't want to. He said it when he was before he was president. I think in between he was vice president, when he was out of office, that infamous speech he's giving, and you can see to his left is Alejandro Mayorkas. And he says that there's going to be an unrelenting stream of non-whites and colored people and people of color into the United States, and it's going to put an end to it, the white ethnic majority in the United States. The white ethnic majority is coming to an end, and that's a good thing. Why is that a good thing? What you're saying is the current white majority is a bad thing, then. Why is that a bad thing? Well, that might give you some indication why he's violating his own oath of office and therefore committing treason.
And who he's supporting? I mean, because the people who are really benefiting are the Judeo-Masonic minority who has political power. So they would benefit tremendously from that process. Whereas, hey, the heritage American Christian Europeans, well, you just lose everything, you know. And you know, just to segue, if you don't mind, I mean, one of the guys that helped bring this about, this whole process, was Zelensky, Saul.
Well, you know, not Zelensky, Alinsky.
Alinsky, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Saul David Alinsky, a good Catholic boy.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, we were going to just mention him briefly, and I wanted to point out just real quick. I mean, you know, he has his rules for radicals, like 14, 15 rules or something. And if you look through them, basically it's just critical theory. And particularly if you look at the rule, there's a number of rules that are kind of related to it. But the rule that's, you know, makes the easiest to understand is where he says, make the enemy live up to its own book of rules. This is kind of a synopsis of critical theory. And what they're saying here is that, you know, you can say, well, look, women don't have equal pay. Therefore, you're not living up to your principle of equality. So you're a hypocrite. And what they're doing is they're isolating the aspect, right, the one aspect that is not seemingly in line with the book of rules that they're presenting. And they are, of course, to do this, they have to forget and remove all of the nuance wherein, you know, sometimes you have to have, you know, different aspects of power are divided, and there is reasons for this. There's benefits. There's things like, well, the women can be at home taking care of children. This is a benefit to society. This isn't brought up, though, when you are using, you know, inequality of income. You know, you don't talk about the nuance. So this is the sophistry. It's the kind of propaganda that Alinsky was training.
What's the economic value of having women at home nurturing, raising children, and the social capital that it develops? Well, they want to destroy that social. They want to seize that capital. That's the thing.
Again, this is workers' paradise, and the goal, of course, ultimately is genocide. They will gain political power through this process, through this bamboozlement, through this sophistry. Women will become alienated from men. There'll be less families, and we'll get to, you know, the current situation we have now. And
They become increasingly neurotic and unable to even assess their own situation.
I found something that was really kind of it's illustrative of where the sophistry ends up, because that just recently you've had the the FAA has gone into a DEI frenzy, right, of trying to hire
Mentally ill people, mentally ill.
they want more diversity because remember, we want to live up to the book of rules. And so equality is the principle. Nothing else matters. We just want equality. And so there was a lawsuit filed by the Mountain States Legal Foundation, and they had in it, presented quotes from the examinations that the FAA is using to get air traffic controllers. Okay, this is the exam. And I wanted to read these because, well, I found them pretty funny. And I think our audience might get some joy in them. So they created an exam. They created an exam to which will have as its goal DEI results, right? This would be the official exam people would be given if you're applying for air traffic controller. So they then ask questions and they award points for your answer. Right now, a candidate would be awarded 15 points, which is the highest possible score, if they indicated that in the question that the lowest grades in high school that they got were in science. Okay, so this would be the highest score. If you had failed science, you would get basically 15 points. Now, in contrast, you would only get 2 points, the lowest score, if you said that, well, you had a pilot's license, right? For example, as part of your background, and 0 points if you had any experience whatsoever as a control tower operator or had instrument flight rules experience. In other words, for the exact experience that someone would need to be an air traffic controller, you would get 0. Now, my favorite ones, though, are if the applicant that you would gain the highest points, 10 points for this question, if you answered that you had not been employed in the last 3 years. If you had been unemployed for the last 3 years, you would get the highest score. Answering yes there gives you 10 points. If you answered you had been employed, no, you get nothing. Now, another question of if you had been unemployed for 5 months, then you would get just 8 points, but you would still get far more than if you had been employed. So the point is here, Tim, you have the end result of
Well, it's completely inverted. It's completely
you have
inverted.
a version of sanity
Yes.
because anyone who has real qualifications for being an air traffic controller is being excluded from being an air traffic controller. And those who cannot have any qualifications really at all, if you look at these test results, they're being given the job. And this is, kind of the end result of when Alinsky started out with, we got to make them live up to the book of rules, equality. They talk about equality. Let's make sure that they, and this is where it ends up. You end up where, because you get rid of meritocracy and all of the obvious benefits that, it would have in society, and you end up here where you get no points if you know anything, and you get the highest points if you fail science at every single turn as a high school student. So.
Well, yeah, the inversion is there. One thing is probably initially it's there to facilitate the hiring and promotion of minorities, people of color who traditionally don't do well in science, who have higher rates of unemployment, and more likely to have all those things that that you cited there. Whereas people who are do well in science or stay employed or tend to be whites or probably I would say Asians, East Asians, and so it's there to make sure that the most incompetent, therefore, the most marginalized are hired. And of course, the result of that is more midair collisions, accidents, planes falling apart, infrastructure decaying, and of
Oh
course,
yeah, I mean,
public
believe me,
safety and suffering. Yeah, so.
if this thing goes forward, you're going to have, there'll be accidents all over the place,
Whoever
and all.
wrote that test is obviously is dedicated to simply destroying the current system. That's some.
That's right. That's all. That's the and they will end up with their DEI paradise, and you'll have no human competency that's required, and it's just going
Well,
to,
this is a good example of an institution like FAA, supposedly designed to facilitate safe air travel, is actually being inverted and twisted, actually do the exact opposite. And this is something that Saul Alinsky would do actually as a community organizer. I think he lived, born 1909, died 1972. He was an activist, left-wing community organizer, and general rabble-rouser in Chicago, who developed a method of local organizing that was widely copied by Democrats and influenced, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. He is credited coining the term community organizer. His most well-known accomplishment, of course, is the book, as you mentioned, The Rules for Radicals, which he dedicated to Lucifer, the first radical. He says he identified with people who would go to hell. So that's where he wants to go when he died, in the
Yeah,
afterlife.
studied to be a rabbi. So there you have it.
But
Dedicates the
one
book.
thing that's interesting, he's radicalizing, he's organizing unions, not evil in of itself. Like, you see what I want to work, nothing wrong with organizing labor to recognizing its capital to get a best deal for that. But at the same time, he's destroying the basis for real effective labor unions by destroying ethnic solidarity, of course. He attended University of Chicago, was unable to find employment, but then he's supposed to be a radical and he's supposed to be a communist, and he did defend the communists. And there was one interview he defended the communists because, interesting enough, according to Alinsky, the Soviet Union was the only state standing up to Hitler. So there's that Jewish solipsism again. That's why his defense for communism was they were standing up to Hitler, of course, ignoring the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and all that. Nevertheless, one thing again, you mentioned how these Alinsky tactics are implemented in DEI and at FAA, and how these institutions are being subverted and inverted, if you will, by this method. Despite him supposed to being a radical and a communist and a rabble-rouser, always enjoyed the largesse of big capital, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the various foundations, the Marshall Fund, the Rockefeller Foundation, and pretty much he was used to domesticate actually radicals to sort of co-opt the new left. And the new left itself was co-opted and controlled by big capital. They were always writing big checks to Alinsky's organizations, and he was there to sort of, in my opinion, to direct protest in a certain direction that was, in the final analysis, congenial to the interest of big capital. He always received huge, large grants, $100,000, multi-$100,000, million-dollar grants to conduct his business. A real radical doesn't get. Isn't well funded by capitalist foundations.
He
So
was
this
just
communist was always being funded by capitalist foundations.
he was BLM. I mean,
Yes.
BLM is exactly what Alinsky was.
I mean, if you like, there was I mean, that's the final analysis, is that one thing is his books are always his books like Rules for Radicals and other leftist material, new leftist material, always enjoyed wide publication, publication and support of the major publishing houses like Random House and Simon and Schuster. So if they're really radical, why are they get this wide publication publicity if they're promoted by the system? That this is sort of a something that really can't be explained if you buy into the narrative, the dialectic, if you will. Why are people like Alinsky and Gloria Steinem being lavished with funds and publicity by the very system that they're supposedly calling for the destruction here, and at the same time, people of the right are not, meaning that you did see something on the right, extremists or radicals, where they simply weren't lavished with funds. They're often prosecuted and marginalized and impoverished, which is an indication they were perhaps more authentic. A good example would be the Alinsky was asked, and I think there was a famous Playboy interview he did just before he died in the early 70s, and he was asked about his main enemy was. And as a person, it wasn't Hitler. It was Father Coughlin, of the National and his National Union for Social Justice, a Catholic organization. And he feared that Father Coughlin was actually leading an organization on a genuinely Catholic mission. And Father Coughlin had started his radio series attacking capitalists and their greed. And his argument was capitalism, greedy capitalists would produce socialism and communism. And Alinsky actually agreed with that, but he said that was a good thing, whereas Father Coughlin said it was a bad thing. So he called for real social justice, sharing the wealth and these things, sort of a distributist attitude. And more importantly, Father Coughlin was very skeptical, at least critical, of FDR's drive to war. I mean, he wanted to keep the United States out of the then, I guess the Brewing War, but then the war that broke out in Europe in 1939. And for some reason, Alinsky was dedicated, along with his fellow tribesmen, to get the U.S. into that war. And so it's interesting that, again, he opposed Coughlin's National Union for Social Justice. And at the same time, Alinsky was very successful in organizing Christian organizations in his own interpretation of social justice movements. And one was he started in the 1960s was the Catholic Campaign for Human Development. He started in the early 1960s. He put the label Catholic on it, but it became a group for social justice, civil rights, all these phrases, catchphrases. And it basically was just dedicated to leftist activism.
Yeah, all of the organizations inside Catholicism and Christianity in general were dissolved into left-wing, anti-European, traditional American, programs. They all flipped. I mean, think of BLM and the way that they were able to work with big capital and Christian organizations. So this has been Alinsky's sophistry has been very successful, right? It's isolated
Well, he
individuals and
marginalizes a genuinely Catholic, like Father Coughlin's outfit, and start, and of course, decades later. But he's also undermining. He saddles up to Catholic bishops, and they start working with him in Chicago.
and think about Norman Lear. We talked about him a couple of weeks ago. He had the same thing with Father Conklin, that was his enemy as a youth, and he dreamt of one day, being able to, oppose this. Well, if you look at, what's going on here, it's just a struggle between ethnicities, in which one side is attacking the other using sophistry, and the other side doesn't seem to have the capacity to recognize this. And Alinsky's rules for radicals, if you go through them, are really just, ways in which people can be organized against heritage America, but against their own ethnicity, often case times, right? So it's just a very clever propaganda, and it we can now see when you look at the FAA test questions where it goes. What actually ends up, being the nature of our government when you start letting these people have their free rein, to try to, set up our structures. I mean, it's and none of this is an accident. This isn't just, a mistake. It's not like the Great Society programs were a blunder. They were designed to destroy African American inner city culture. They were designed to do it, and they did it. Alinsky is not trying to set up a workers' paradise. He's trying to destroy basically European civilization. This and so that's why when then you come to the FAA test results, you shouldn't and questions, you shouldn't be surprised. This wasn't, it wasn't, it didn't go wrong, Tim. It went right. It was an attack. It had camouflage, intellectual camouflage, and now we're seeing the fruits of it, where they're going to create an absolute, I mean, intellectually debased, and of course, obviously morally debased. They talk about the Great Replacement. We see the immigrants coming across to replace Europeans in America. But remember, this is all part of a larger debasement, the great debasement of Europe's European populations that's going on here and in Europe, which was described in the authoritarian personality, where they're going to flip the bit to Eros, to sex, drugs, rock and roll, and that will be the your ticket out of sort of Christian culture and into this real fun, brave new world, which ends up with, well, you can't get a job if you're a white person, right? We saw the statistics of since the BLM publicity, where it was like, what, like only 6% of the hiring of the Fortune 500 in that period, in the last 2.5 years, had been white people in America, were the majority. So you can see where this is all going. They're defunding us, and then they will depopulate us. This is our world.
Well, Alinsky claimed to represent the have-nots against the haves. That was his claim. He wrote, "All societies discourage and penalize ideas and writings that threaten the ruling status quo. It is understandable, therefore, that the literature of the have society is a veritable desert whenever we look for writings on social change." Yet his seminal book on community organizing, Rules for Radicals, was published by a major establishment institution, Random House, in 1971. I'm reading from a book called Generation 68. It's a new book by Kerry Bolton about the controlled left. And he's a chapter on Saul Alinsky. He says, the year before Jerry Rubin was published by Simon & Schuster, conversely, according to Alinsky's perception. From the haves, on the other hand, there has come an unceasing flood of literature justifying the status quo. Religion, economic, social, political, and legal tracts endlessly attack all revolution ideas and action for change as immoral, fallacious, and against God, country, and mother. That's what Alinsky claimed. The myth of the established suppression of left-wing dissent had to be maintained despite being patently false. Something was askew with Alinsky's observation. What was this unceasing flood of literature justifying the status quo from the haves? Herbert Marcuse was, like Alinsky, sponsored by the Rockefellers. Alfred Kinsey's controversial studies on sexology were funded by the Rockefellers. Gunnar Myrdal's seminal book on American blacks was sponsored by the Carnegie Corporation. Eric Fromm's repudiation of the primary ties of family, faith, and homeland, Escape from Freedom, was published by Farrar and Reinhardt. Theodore Adorno's study of the authoritarian personality, ascribing latent fascism intrinsically to God, country, and mother, was published by Harper and Row. Abby Hoffman's Woodstock Nation, a talk rock album, was published by Random House in 1969. The same year that Dell published The Conspiracy, the Chicago Eight Speak Out, an account of the defendant tried for instigating the riots of 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Haves were no custodians of God, country, and mother, to paraphrase Alinsky. Within a few months, the committee had reached a representation from 120 publishers, the extent to which there were sufficient publishers to maintain an unceasing flood of conservative-oriented literature is difficult to imagine, meaning there's nothing close to on the right that was promoted by the left by supposedly the conservative status quo institutions, the foundations, the corporations. So Alinsky was a front for the haves by posing as a have-not or an advocate for the have-not, because he was his activism, advocating socialism, atomization, sexual degeneracy, all this stuff would actually deprive of the have-nots of the social capital, the ability to negotiate with the haves. So basically, he was undermining their position by posing as an advocate for them. So
that's such good information, Tim. That's really sort of clear, you know, is that that's just the bamboozlement, right?
Yes.
We're the have-nots, you're the haves, and we're going to use all of our financial power, which is 1,000 times more than yours, to destroy the haves and promote the have-nots, you know.
Yes.
Well, wait a second, you know, this doesn't make any sense. It's not real. But it's just how we're bamboozled, you know.
Yeah. I heard a report at National Public Radio. Yeah. There was a report, one of the typical reports, where two gals were talking about how the recent efforts to convince young men to spurn pornography and stop masturbating was a gateway to extremism. So if a guy tries to get his act together, you know, establish some discipline over his disordered passions, get control of his life, the desire to pair bond with a woman and start a family, well, he's going to become a Nazi.
Well, and you know, and if you look at the authoritarian personality, that's right. This is a step toward fascism.
Everything healthy is pathological and dangerous. Everything healthy.
This is what they've done. They define any kind of strength in European culture as neurotic and also dangerous and leading to fascism. And so they, if you are not kind of prepared to defend yourself against the sophistry and the propaganda, which so many like young European traditional Americans, and also, you know, remember, this isn't just against white people. This, the same crap is inside the inner city.
Oh, of course. Right? It's obviously more devastating, much more devastating.
African-American, they get the exact same, you know, they get it from a different perspective because they're said, well, you're the have not, so you need more pornography.
Well, blacks are the most sexually liberated, right?
Yeah, there you go. Right.
Family.
And look, and
There you go.
they're liberated from the effects of family because they're having so few of them. And where does that going to take them ultimately? Genocide. It always ends up with you're off the planet. You see, this is you get the smiley face and all of look, you're getting just what you want, and we're giving you all these terrific stuff. Look at all of like the sexual
Was it
liberation. Look
Norman
at
Mailer who said that whites actually envied blacks? The white
yeah.
Negro, was it where he said that we envied the liberation, their exuberance, and the kind of their free willing?
Right. And
Yeah.
we did that because we knew that our sexual restraint was ultimately neurotic, just like Freud had told us, that if we could just get rid of that, we would not be prone to be fascistic, right? We'd be happy, the world would be a better place. I don't see much of this, kind of being levied against, like, well, say people in Israel, somehow they are excluded from any of this this analysis. So it's, look, it's just it had
Well,
they
there
have
should be a
all.
book carton, sort of a book, say the maybe they could title the Judaic personality, and
Yeah, that would
sort of
be kind
analyze the
of fun.
solipsism and the neuroticism of
And you know
the
what? You would
Jews.
ask, you could actually plug that into reality far better than the authoritarian
Yes.
personality into reality, which is just it's ludicrous because it defines what is obviously ethnic and individual strength as neurotic, but the thing about such a book is that the main value would be just to expose the nature of the attack, because this is really what is needed now more than anything else.
You could develop a J scale,
Sure you could. Of course you could. Are you
which
kidding
much
me?
by the way, with much more like reliable data and
Well, you could give a
much
lot more
reality.
examples
Yeah.
because the examples of fascism, these white supremacists, well, they don't exist. I mean, I have never met in my life a white supremacist that I'm aware of. I don't know any people who are, in kind of that world of, I know preppers, know a lot of them, but I don't know any of them that are white supremacists. They just want to get the hell away from what they see as chaos,
Yeah.
So, and in fact, the preppers tend to be cowards. They want to live in a bunker in a forest. They don't want to like do the courageous thing, which is to get a coffee table at the farmer's market and stand up for their culture,
Yeah, engage people. They want to get away
engage.
from it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is the thing, is that they're encouraged to, maybe in these white supremacists. I mean, they don't exist. So the whole premise of the authoritarian personality is, well, it's non-existent. It's just
It just
surface.
says it all that if you advocate.
If you did the J scale, man, I could come up with some examples.
Well, it's so telling that if you advocate sexual continence, personal responsibility, morality, sobriety, dedication to family,
Family, yeah.
respect for proper authority, like the father, you're an anti-Semite. So all those, but you're saying is, so if you advocate a normal approach to life, healthy, reproductive, degenerative as opposed to the degenerative part aspect, approach to life, you're an anti-Semite. So what does that say about them?
Oh, I mean, it says that we should be anti-Semites
Based on their
because
definition, yes.
they are they're engaged in genocide. And how can we? But again, be very careful with this because anti-Semitism is a cul-de-sac. It's incoherent. It isn't the Jews as a race.
No, it's not.
They
Well, that's the distinction. You're
manipulate.
not saying they're genetically required to think this way. It's
To
it
deal
may
with the
appear that way now
oligarchs.
because after a millennia of tradition and of identifying with the Talmud and
Well, they controlled
developing survival strategies or coping strategies, which produce which is by definition, misanthropic towards everyone else. It appears as almost like it is genetic.
I remember when I was in high school, and the war, 6 Day War, I think, was going on, and there was a Jewish friend of mine, and he said, he says, I just really want to support Israel because they're so small, they're so tiny, and they're just defending themselves against these overwhelming odds, And if you think of the different kind of degrees of like weapons and military power, Israel, even at that time, was more powerful than all of the Arab states combined.
Well,
And
because
that individual,
it had supported the Jewish global empire, the
because
diaspora.
they had worldwide Jewry support, and of course,
Yes.
the British Empire. Anyway, the point is that
I mean,
individual, my friend.
how did the Jews impose an international boycott on Germany in 1933
Right.
if they're
How
powerless?
do you, they had no parallel. But you see, my
Yes.
friend, he was the victim of propaganda. He had been given this victim tradition. Well, the Holocaust, for one
Oh,
thing,
of
but
course,
also
yeah.
just the whole idea, like we're perpetually a victim, and you are perpetually attacking us, and all we ever do is defend ourselves. This had been given to him. And it really had affected his ability to even to see, something as basic as the different levels of military power that the two sides were possessing at that
Yeah,
point. Yeah.
it just completely skewed. Like today, it's completely skewed reality. I was talking to someone that we had. I remember last spring, I had to sit back and listen to oh, what's his name? The second gentleman, Kamala Harris's husband.
Oh, Kamala Harris's husband. No, he's a piece of work.
What's his
Yeah.
name again?
I don't know. He's some Jewish guy.
He's a Hollywood. He's a multi. He's like worth like $100 million.
Yeah, of course.
Doug Emhoff. Doug Emhoff. There you go. He's a Hollywood lawyer or something, or one of the people that run Hollywood. He's worth like $100 million. He married her, Kamala Harris, and here he is last spring at a podium at the White House, speaking at the National Conference to Combat Anti-Semitism. He's worth $100 million. He lives in a gated community far away from the diversity his tribe promotes, all the problems. Never probably wanted for anything that money can buy in his entire life. And he's telling me, because I'm watching it, he's telling the United States, here I am struggling to make ends meet, raising my family. He's telling me that he's the victim. He's a victim.
Yeah.
He's under threat. There's been no more society that's been more of a paradise for Jews than the United States in the history of the
Yeah.
world. And here he is worth $100 million. Wealthiest, probably the wealthiest group in the United States, they're the victim. And we have to put up with that.
Yeah. So it's a lack of courage among other things. The intimidation, the self-correcting, oh my God, they'll call me anti-Semite, they'll call me a Holocaust denier, they'll call me a conspiracy theorist. I can't have these insults directed against me, so I'm going to keep my mouth shut. That has to come to a stop.
How
It's
dare you question my motivations? How dare you challenge me? I had
yeah.
relatives who died in the Holocaust.
Right.
It's like,
Well, if all of your relatives died in the Holocaust, how did you come into existence?
I know. It's like, what? If they all died, how come you're here? Please. So, okay, Joe.
All right, Tim, thank you so much, brother. We'll get him next week.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.